These words are a found poem by Dalton Wright, who used one page of text from Jack Kerouac's Alone on a Mountaintop. What strange thoughts come to you when you realize, I realized I didn't have to hide myself. Seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, tasting, thinking, to perceive at all. The fear, the chase, it's ultimately silly. The mountain meadow side in the moonlight, you're already there. You're already there. It's God's universal mind, like the silence of an infant's smile. Let's join our hearts and minds in the spirit of prayer and meditation. May the spirit that unites all people in all places be with us now as we try to live lives of peace and justice. Here, gathered in this sanctuary, let us give thanks for the gifts of creation, and let us find new strength to address the brokenness in our world. May our hands and hearts reach out to the people still suffering from natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes, floods. We seek faith that sustains us in times of trouble, that keeps us strong, imaginative, resistant. May our prayers reach those rebuilding lives in the midst of devastation. And may we be agents of mercy, bringing comfort however we can. But may we also have strength to cope with the tragedies that are not natural, the horrors that arise from hatred and greed and a love of violence. May we resist the temptation to turn inwards. Instead, together, find a way forward so we can make our land one of peace. One that makes sense. May we work to build greater justice and equality and learn to welcome the stranger. Help us to always keep all that is holy in our minds as we keep trying to reform this world in a way that honors creation. Let us dare to love one another and to believe in peace. Amen. The reading this morning is from a book called On Trails by Robert Moore. In 1846, Henry David Thoreau made a failed bid to climb Mount Katahdin, the highest peak in the state of Maine. His guide was an old Indian man named Louis Neptune, who advised Thoreau to leave a bottle of rum on the top of the mountain to appease the mountain spirit. On their climb, Thoreau and his companions followed moose trails and scrambled cross-country. In one harrowing instance, while crawling over the flattened tops of the black spruce trees that had grown up between the mountain's massive boulders, Thoreau looked down to find that below him, in the crevices, lay the sleeping forms of bears. The party became lost in the fog and never made it to the summit. But on his descent, Thoreau suddenly realized that he had stumbled upon an entirely wild place. He found the land savage and unspeakably beautiful. He wrote, "This was that earth of which we have heard, made out of chaos and old night. Here was no man's garden, but the untamed globe. It was not lawn, nor pasture, nor woodland, nor even wasteland. Man was not to be associated with it. This was matter, vast, terrific rocks, trees, wind on our cheeks, the solid earth, the actual world, the common sense, contact." Well, how had a human being, indeed a whole generation of human beings, become so abstracted from the land as to warrant such an epiphany? Solid earth, actual world? The answer stretches back through agriculture and literacy and urbanization and technology, and through monotheism, which vanquished the animist spirits and erased their earthly shrines. Euro-Americans had been working for millennia to forget what an unpeopled planet looked like. To see it afresh came as a shock. Katahdin attracted pilgrims who enjoyed its wild character and who would fight to keep it that way. In 1920, an eccentric millionaire named Percival Baxter climbed Katahdin, and impressed, he vowed to ensure that the land would remain forever wild, simple and natural, nearly as it was when only the Indians and the animals roamed at will through these areas. So in a very real way, wilderness is a human creation, born when we began cleaving the world into the binary categories of wild and tame, natural and cultivated. Perhaps the most succinct definition of the wilderness is simply the not self. There, in the one place we have not remolded in our own image, a very deep and ancient form of wisdom can be found. Wilderness is a brazenly naked land where a person in mingled fear and awe, verging on nonsense, can cry out for contact. A Penobscot story begins with a young Native American girl gathering blueberries on Mount Katahdin. Because she was lonely, she wished for a husband. And then, seeing the great mountain in all its glory with the red sunlight on the top, she added, "I wish Katahdin were a man and would marry me." She went up the mountain, picking her blueberries and singing to herself, and was not seen again for 3 years. When the girl reappeared, she had with her a beautiful baby whose eyebrows were made of stone. The spirit of the mountain had indeed taken the lonely girl as his bride, but after a time she wished to see her own people. The mountain, wanting only peace and goodness for her, sent his bride back down. The baby boy had strange and wondrous gifts. The wise men among the Penobscot said he was born to be a mighty magician. All he had to do was point a finger at a moose, and it would drop dead. When out in a canoe, if he pointed to a flock of wild ducks, the water would at once be covered with floating game for the people to gather in. So through this gift, the mother and child and all the tribe had plenty of food and never any worries. So this was a truth and a mystery, too. The Katahdin had wedded this girl and created a child who would build up his nation and make of the Wabanaki a mighty race. But before the girl had gone back down the mountain, the great spirit of the mountain told her that she must not allow the people to inquire about the boy's father. He said, "Truly, they will all know it by seeing him anyway. It's an impertinence on their part to ask. Do not let them bother you." So she made it known that she would not be questioned. She didn't talk about the spirit of the mountain or the life that it gave her. Then one day, knowing that people were talking about her behind her back, she said to herself in frustration, "Katahdin was right. These people are not worthy of my son. He shall not serve them and lead them to victory anymore. These are not people who would make a great nation." And when someone said one thing too many, she finally spoke out, and she told the people they were like mud wasps who stung the fingers of those who plucked them out of the water when they were drowning. She said they were likely to kill themselves with their stupid mistakes. "Why are you troubling me to tell you what you already know? Can't you see who is the father of my boy? Look at his eyebrows. Don't you know Katahdin by those? Well, now you'll be sorry you ever asked. From this day on, feed yourselves. Find your own venison. We will do no more for you." Then she stood up, made her way into the woods and up the mountain, and was never seen on this earth again. Last summer, as June turned into July, my husband and two of my sons drove to Baxter State Forest in order to hike to the top of Mount Katahdin. They had romantic notions of conquering high peaks, balancing along the knife's edge, and in the case of the 64-year-old, completing an item on the list of things he must accomplish before succumbing to old age. In the case of the 17-year-old, proving his independence while lounging by sun-dappled stone pools above the clouds. The 19-year-old was just going in order to go. And a third teenager, a friend of our boys, accompanied them. So this is a story from behind the stage by one who did not go, me. Now, I heard the response when somebody mentioned my four sons, so you know what my life is like. These guys didn't read up on the park. They didn't read about the rules for toileting or how you have to hang your food in bags from up in the trees away from your tent so the bears won't visit in the night. They didn't realize that the road into the park was more like a rutted 20-mile path that would take almost 2 hours to drive. I bought them trail maps. I researched how much water was necessary, and I packed that up for them, too. I encouraged them to do a little bit more homework. But my husband was busy working, and my son thought all of this was superfluous. When David showed up so they could all head out, he had no backpack or sleeping bag because Asher, my son, had reassured us. He had told me that David would have everything, even the things he didn't have. But Asher had never told David how long a trip this was or even that they were camping. They left amidst a discussion of extra chargers for their cell phones. Meanwhile, my third son and I drove to our cottage in Midcoast, Maine, where we were supposed to meet up with the climbers on the third day. Levi and I puttered around the beach, and we bumped into our neighbor, Jim, and explained to him where the rest of our gang was. Then Jim began telling me about being lost on the mountain. This is a story he told me. In July of 1939, a 12-year-old boy was climbing Katahdin with his father and two brothers when a sudden storm came up and covered the top of the peak in a fog so dense that Don Fendler lost sight not only of his family, but the trail. Just as he reached the summit, the mist closed in and shut off the view of anything below the peak. The clouds settled in, then a storm followed. First, it was lashing rain, then snow and ice, and then the soaked little boy ended up completely and totally lost. After a few days, the search and rescue mission became one in which the authorities hoped to recover a body. Fendler's last footprints were found at the edge of a precipice that fell 400 feet. All of America was united in praying for this boy. His mother was receiving thousands of Western Union telegrams. Boy Scouts across New England joined with the Maine paper mill workers and the New York State Police bloodhounds to look for him. And 9 days later, he emerged, naked and battered and delirious, having lost 30% of his body weight, with hundreds of black fly bites and missing a few toes. He had walked through 48 miles of extreme wilderness with no supplies at all. He had even lost his pants and his shoes. He had survived on berries and faith. Now, I wasn't sure at all how I felt about Jim telling me all this. It was interesting to learn of his passion for collecting all information related to this story and about the tension that this has created in his own marriage, the scrapbooks Jim has created about this story and its aftermath, the times he'd gone to meet Don Fendler at public appearances across the state of Maine. But I kept thinking about my own husband and sons and wondering if I would ever see them again. It seemed a little bit insensitive of my neighbor to be dwelling on this story about being lost on Katahdin while my family was, in fact, on Katahdin, even if Jim's story did end with the miraculous. I periodically reminded myself that if something terrible had befallen my husband and children, the chaplain for the Maine State Wardens would call me. And I actually know her. She's a UU minister. And for some stupid reason, this seemed comforting to me. It wouldn't change the facts, but I guess the bearer of the news makes a difference. I did not go on this trip mainly out of fear. There are times and places when I simply cannot cope with my youngest son's free spirit and lack of limits. This was one of them. I knew I would be absolutely terrified to see him dancing along the boulders, and I would much rather be useless from a distance. I thought about the Penobscot tale of that little girl picking blueberries and curing her loneliness by falling in love with the fire-tipped peak of Katahdin and disappearing into a cloud on the summit to emerge with a sun, his brow made of bits of chiseled stone, like Moses on Sinai, receiving the law for his people. How do we make our way to these heights? Even though I'm afraid of my son's wildness, I understand that spirit. I feel it too. This desire to be elemental somehow, to be strong and natural and in tune, to feel free, and yet also feel connected to the powers that keep creation humming along. I've never forgotten a book I read in third grade called My Side of the Mountain, which I suppose now I realize is a fantasy, but I certainly didn't read it that way at the time. It seemed to me a revelation, teaching me how to be holy and closer to heaven. It made living purely seem both something desirable and possible. In this book, a boy named Sam goes off to find land that had belonged to his great-grandfather. And the disinterested adults say things like, "Oh, every boy should have a good adventure," basically ignoring him and expecting an insignificant foray followed by a return to the overcrowded New York City apartment with the siblings and the noise and the cars and the buses and the people everywhere. But armed with $40, flint and steel, an axe and some string, Sam makes his way to the Catskills, to the mountain of his tribe. He burns out the interior of a rotted tree to create a home. He learns how to fish, draws maps so he can get oriented. He climbs higher and higher, tracking a falcon to her nest. Then he scales a cliff and snatches a fledgling for his own. The bird becomes his friend and his piece of wildness, too. He trains the falcon, but he feels her flight in his own bones, just as the light of the sky becomes his own vision. Curiously, I'm reading the adult version of this right now, Helen MacDonald's H is for Hawk, which, after sitting on my list for a long time, my husband bought for me. This book has that same intense intimacy, grappling with our human place in creation, examining predatory behavior and the idea of tameness, the impulse to be both an authentic self, alone before the powers of the universe, and yet also deeply connected to family and traditions and something beyond all that in the sky. MacDonald's book, though, is true. She really does train hawks. And like Sam, connecting to his family and its past, MacDonald's relationship with her hawk is a way of exploring her identity and mourning the loss of her father. She writes, "The hawk was a fire that burned all my hurts away. She was my refuge." Although at first these might look like stories of running away, retreating from life, they're actually about finding those experiences that will teach us what we need to know, connecting us to that which makes us fully human. These are both followers of Moses on Sinai or Thoreau on that Katahdin trip, making contact with what? Something that's not just an idea, something that's not of our own creation. What will guide us? What is it that's revealed to us from on high that will show us how to live down here? We all live both vertically and horizontally. We reach for communion with the spirits above our heads and with those who walk beside us. And when those who accompanied us disappear, how do we keep walking? How do we find them again? It's easy in stories like this or in a faith like ours to think that the tale is about self-sufficiency. But the bigger part of the story is about living in harmony with a spirit we don't know how to talk about, that evaporates when we try to put it into words, and yet which rules us somehow. Those stone eyebrows of Katahdin's son, whose finger could stop a moose in its tracks, or the laws cut into Moses' stone tablets by God's finger inside a vast cloud on top of a fiery mountain. Even that hawk's gorgeous flight into the heavens is predicated on death. Life has its rules. When Don Fendler emerged after being lost on the mountain, his rescue was a balm to the nation. His survival let others see things in themselves that they hadn't thought about or dared to believe in. And for him, those 9 days shaped the course of the rest of his life. He credited his survival to his faith, his determination to see his father and brothers and mother. And so the story of being lost was really more about hope and perseverance and love. Fendler's father had a business making clerical vestments and church supplies. And I love how that exterior work is such a complement to the inner transformation. Finding the holy, witnessing the laws of creation. Fendler returned to Katahdin every single summer for the rest of his life, which ended this past October. And at his request, his ashes were brought to the top of the mountain and scattered to the wind. My men obviously did return from Katahdin, essentially unscathed, but definitely humbled, with an appreciation for the scale of this world and our radical dependence on grace to survive. They did it. The weather cooperated. But they had traveled too lightly. They left the water in the car rather than carry the weight, and had to be given drinks by passing strangers and food from fellow climbers. Yes, I'm getting some good mileage out of that. They were impressed by the realization that as hard as it was to reach the summit, the descent was far more brutal. Back to earth, changed, and yet with nothing changed. In a letter about his climb, Thoreau said he felt as if he had been translated while up there, but that it's after we get home that we really go over the mountain, if indeed we ever do. One summer, copying Thoreau's Walden Pond experiment in living intentionally, Jack Kerouac worked as a fire lookout on Desolation Peak in Washington State. Early on, one night, he woke up in terror and saw a huge black shadow in the window. He wrote, "Then I saw it had a star above it, and I realized that this was the 8,000-foot Mount Hosamine looking into my window from miles away. I went outside and gasped to see black mountain shapes gianting all around, and not only that, but the billowing of the northern lights shifting behind the clouds. It was all a little too much for a city boy, and the fear had me hiding under my bed. But in the morning, I was overjoyed to see a clear blue sky and down below the clouds making a marshmallow cover for all the world, while I abided in warm sunshine among hundreds of miles of snow-white peaks. That night, I just lay on the mountain meadowside in the moonlight, head to grass, and heard the silent recognition of my temporary woes." Yes, so to try to attain nirvana when you're already there, to attain to the top of a mountain when you're already there, I decided that when I would go back down to the world, I would try to keep my mind clear in the midst of murky human ideas smoking like factories on the horizon. I could just walk forward, blessing the mountain and thanking it for the lesson. These closing words are from a letter of Thoreau's to a friend. "I keep a mountain anchored off eastward a little way, which I ascend in both my dreams, awake and asleep. I find that I go up to it when I'm light-footed and when I'm earnest. It ever smokes like an altar with its sacrifice. I'm not aware that a single villager frequents it or knows of it, but I keep this mountain to ride instead of a horse."